right. Good afternoon, KD&K listeners, to another show of Weight Off Your Shoulders. And we are going to be talking about healthcare today with Diane Mitz-Bush, who is a congressional candidate for the Congressional District Number 3 in Colorado. Diane, if you can hear me, welcome to the show. I have Steve Reynolds also here, and we're going to welcome everyone to listen in.
Hi, Diane.
Hey, Steve. Hi, Edward.
Good to hear your voice.
Thanks for having me.
You're very, very welcome. We're extremely interested in getting your take on some of the things going on with healthcare in the country, and specifically to Colorado, and even more specific to the Congressional District number 3 that you're running in. And so what I do is just basically go right to the top here. Diane, what do you think is best for Coloradans, single-payer universal care, state-based multi-payer universal care, or keep and strengthening the Affordable Care Act, and basically why?
Right. Let me start with the why. As I think you know, we're the only industrialized country that does not have universal access to health care. Insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies control pricing. They control patient interaction with their doctors, and they impede the ability of doctors to provide care. They also lead to very excessive administrative costs and to cost shifting. Many of us are paying for things we don't even know we're paying. So the direct answer to the question, I believe, given the data that I know of and all my work in the Colorado House on healthcare issues and insurance premiums, is that some form of single-payer universal care will help us to make sure that everyone is covered and that costs are lowered while quality is maintained. Now, that said, universal coverage takes lots of forms. Single-payer, as opposed to single-payer provider, single-payer means the government pays either through taxes or fees, and the care is privately provided to physicians, clinics, nurse practitioners, PTs, whatever. Medicare is an example of that, as are the Canadian system, the Australian system. The other single-payer system is the single-payer provider system. The British system is a really good example of that, as is the VA. And there are certainly hybrids, and you mentioned them in your question, like the multi-payer universal care. That's used in Germany and Switzerland and several other hybrids of that, even, you see in Europe. One of the problems with that is that because you have multiple providers, they're usually nonprofit insurance companies, you have more bureaucracy, you have more administrative costs. So that's why I think that the single payer with us all, and that's who's paying, let's face it, nothing's free, and privately provided care would solve a lot of the problems that we see.
Okay. And Steve, what did you think about that idea? You know, the question and Diane's conclusion. Yeah, anything to add on there?
One of the things that I've kind of thought as we've talked about the various definitions of stuff is that in the United States, we actually do have, by some definitions, universal health care. Anybody can go to the hospital and get care. We just force them into the most expensive source of that. And then we all, like Diane said, we all do the cost shift and everybody else pays for it. Where if we could help a person prevent that high-cost trip to the emergency room, then the system would probably still end up paying for it, but that would be the a less expensive way of providing that service. The, you know, just as the answer to so as a result, I think we have universal health care as by some definitions. I don't think I would want to live in a society where we turn people away because they couldn't afford health care and let people die on the hospital steps. That would be awful. And as it pertains to the single-payer
portion of the question. I know that there's also a couple of countries that are using a multi-payer universal health care system, and our Club 20 group is actually investigating some of that. However, personally, I think that the way the Affordable Care Act was actually written and rolled out, it had a lot of really good components to it. And then insurance companies started to redefine some of that stuff, and it got away from the intent of the bill. And some of the best things about the Affordable Care Act were lost when they changed their definitions and how it was rolled out. So I don't know that I don't like to fall into just broad categories like that, but I do believe that we need to rework our system. We do need to make it where healthcare is affordable and accessible to everybody in the most efficient way possible. And even some of the more conservative people who are knowledgeable will admit that revisiting some of these payment structures and these bureaucracies needs to be done.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that, especially with the last part. I mean, right now we have a highly bureaucratic system where some people do fall out. We still have somewhere between 20 and 25 million people uninsured. And, Steve, you're absolutely right. I mean, they end up going to the emergency room, which is really a shame for several reasons. One, it costs us all with cost shifting. And two, often when they get there, what could have been a preventable, treatable disease isn't, whether it's cancer, whether it's heart disease, whatever it is. And I think part of that is also the emphasis in our system on what I call after the fact. In other words, instead of preventive care and helping people lead more healthy lifestyles, instead what you get is this emphasis on sickness. And you're right. I mean, I think the Affordable Care Act has a lot of really good parts to it. And I certainly don't want to throw that out, baby out with the bath, until we have another system ready to roll. And quite frankly, politically, I don't think that's going to happen for several years. So I think what we should be doing in the meanwhile is fixing some of those glitches. And they are that in the Affordable Care Act. For example, here's one, easy to fix, I think. Under the Affordable Care Act, if you have a couple and one member of the couple is insured by their employer, but that employer doesn't insure spouses, okay, so the spouse is out on the exchange, they count both their income. So
the family glitch.
Total glitch. And I've had a lot of constituents, you know, when I was in the State House, call me and say, oh, my God. And I said, yeah, oh, my God. So we've tried to make some fixes, but it's been at the state level.
I would say my wife and I are actually in that situation. So, So we're just both on the exchange. But I guess there's a philosophical issue, I guess, with this, too. And that is, what is more expensive, the corporate bureaucracy or a government bureaucracy? There's going to be someone administering and managing healthcare one way or another. And there may even be a blend, you say, some sort of a hybrid. But I'm in favor of the least expensive method of getting that done, however it is, to the economy, because I think that would free up money and human resources to do something significantly more profitable and more productive. But just moving on here.
Let me get back to the cost thing. If you look at the other industrialized countries, all of which have some form, some have a more multi-payer, some have a single payer, they pay on the average 12% of their GDP on health care. We spend over 18%, and the rate's rising really fast, and we don't get as good health outcomes for our people as they do. So back to your admin question, I think with one administrative body, instead of dozens and dozens, and just the forms alone are mind-boggling. Why not have one form, you know, and one way to do it, and still you have each provider and patient team, because that's what it is. It's a team between a patient and their PT or their doctor or their whomever, deciding what's the best care. And right now it's not the doctor who decides the best care. It's the insurance company.
All right, and now I want to get to a little bit more of a localized situation. and is what can be done about the elapsed time for acute medical care in rural areas. And just as a backdrop for people, Colorado has about 2 hospital beds per 1,000 residents, 1.9. The U.S. average is about 2.4 per 1,000 people. And Congressional District has a mathematical need for about 1,350 beds based on that. And there are exactly 100 beds in hospitals in the Roaring Fork Valley, including 75 beds at Valley View and 25 at Aspen Valley Hospital. Now, what can be done to improve the distribution of hospital beds in rural areas? Because there are logistic issues. And can remote clinics be encouraged or developed to mitigate those logistic issues? Because that, you know, some people literally could be dying because they simply don't have, you know, a short enough, transit time from a point of acute illness or injury to where they can get, satisfactory medical care. What can
in
be done?
Some parts of CD3, it's 2 hours or more to the nearest hospital, mostly in the Southwest and the San Luis Valley. So there are two things. One is at the end of your question. I'll get to that in a minute. But the other is we need to beef up and fund ambulance services. If you look at some of the health care bills that are now before the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, they don't focus on ambulance, and it's because they have an urban approach. EMS, Emergency Medical Services, and well-equipped ambulances are the key for the very rural areas, because if they're well-equipped, if you have paramedics, and if they have communication with an ER doctor, that is by a radio, by a phone, whatever, they can do the emergency work until you get the patient to a hospital or, like at the end of your question, remote clinics. The federally qualified community health clinics, like in the valley there, Mountain Family, those exist throughout the third CD. Right now, Congress has not refunded them. They will, I think. I hope, because they're very effective. People go there not just for acute emergency situations, but they also go for preventative family medicine. So I think that combination of a good ambulance authority, district authority system linked throughout our district and throughout each county and neighboring counties, with paramedic staff, and then also our rural health clinics.
I think Steve has a question here. Steve Reynolds in the studio with me sharing this. This is fantastic.
So Diane hit on a lot of the issues with the rural versus the urban, and that is in fact the problem. Colorado is not the only state in the union that has that issue. Everybody does. There seems to be a big resistance amongst the industry to try to resolve or even address that. There's also a number of different ways of measuring that type of care. I read a book written by a healthcare economist that was suggesting that there should be one triage hospital for 50,000 people. And in Denver, that's almost one on every corner. And out here in the rural areas, that's one in the whole Western Slope and one on the Eastern Plains. And not literally, but without a doubt, in the Roaring Fork Valley here where we are, that would probably be one triage type hospital, not what we have with Valley View, not what we have with Aspen Valley Hospital. But then, and this is bringing the cost back into play. And then the other piece of that argument then becomes what a person is in the hospital for, and the triage gets them stabilized and then sent out to a more populated area where the you have the specialist. And if you look at the healthcare that we have in the Roaring Fork Valley, I would say we're probably one of the only communities. Glenwood Springs is one of the only communities of 10,000 people that has a neurosurgeon, a couple of neurologists, a state-of-the-art cancer center right here in town. And even though we have the great health care, the cost has to be divided by 10,000 instead of 2 million.
Right. Well, the other piece of it, there's a great example of the kind of facility you're talking about in Cortez.
Right.
They have a very small hospital. I've forgotten the bed number, but basically it's not a hospital like Valley View
right.
or other hospitals that are closer to the I-70 corridor. Basically, they treat the basic acute problems, and then either the patient goes to Durango
right.
or the patient goes to Grand Junction.
Another thing that you were talking about, and really specifically what the question asked, is about the transportation and the access to treatment. When the Affordable Care Act first passed, Marguerite Salazar from the Division of Insurance had put together had put together a task force or hired a consulting company to find out what they thought accessibility to treatment was going to be statewide. And I made it down to Denver to see the results of that study. And they kept talking about these places out in the West, and they were just gray areas. They didn't have numbers on them. And and they answered the questions of how long it took. Well, it's such a small number of people. And I said, but it's still thousands of people. And a lot of those people are our friends, you know?
Exactly.
Or, and family. Neighbors. They're human beings.
Right. Exactly.
Except they're that too.
Right. To the surprise of many, they are not just numbers.
That's right.
or
well,
SKU codes.
That's one of the problems with our current system. Because insurance companies are looking for numbers, they press doctors and hospitals to really deal in numbers. Well, you need to spend 15 minutes for this diagnostic code. And if you spend more than that, you know, we're not going to reimburse you. Well, you spend 7 minutes for this. And that just, it doesn't work, because for good health care, the physician or the nurse practitioner or the PA, whatever it is, you know, whatever kind of provider it is, has to have a relationship with the patient, a trust, because for so many illnesses, it depends in part on the patient giving the doctor the info to be able to treat it well. And so, that whole numbers thing is, I mean, obviously we need data, of course. As you both know, I'm a nerd, and I love data, but it's really the human factor that's critical here.
Well, you can join a nerd crew here.
That's right.
So I do want to ask you, and this may be a little bit unusual, but is the specialist general practitioner ratio too high, and can preventive policies be used to limit the escalating costs of specialists? Where if there is a greater focus on prevention as opposed to heroic reactionary types of medicine, then is there something that can be done about that? That is a huge thing, because that also relates to the mitigation of end of life costs, where obviously
And you skipped a whole bunch of questions, but we can come back to.
Oh yeah, that's because we're kind of like on that
short on time.
That
okay.
financial that the money costs.
Cool. The specialist general practice ratio in the United States is far too high. Period. But it's also far higher than other countries. And as you point out so well, Edward, I mean, preventive medicine is the key here. It's often underpaid. It's underappreciated. Primary care is really what keeps people healthy. In order to have a high-functioning system, we need to transform our healthcare delivery system to rely more on primary care. Part of that, for us, is CD3, is incentives. For family doctors, family practice docs, nurse practitioners, PAs, the whole gamut of primary care providers to come out here. And there are different ways to do that. You can do it with help with college debt, with medical school debt. You can do it with a direct tax incentive. You can do it in a variety of different ways. You have to, of course, get a promise, a contractual promise. They're going to stay for a period of time. And we've been doing that very successfully, ironically, with veterinarians. And with teachers. And there's no reason we couldn't do it with family practice docs. I mean, the salary for family practice is far, far lower than specialist care. And in my opinion, given what I've read and studied for the past 20 years about healthcare, it should be the opposite.
I couldn't agree more. And, as someone who took a look at some of the I guess, other countries, the way they take a look at things, it seems to me that maybe one of the fundamental keys to them getting better healthcare results or efficiency, if you will, like, for instance, the way the World Health Organization would take a look at it, is that there is this far greater emphasis on that preventive care.
Yep.
And that seems to mitigate the need for specialists who come in with heroic tactics and you know, titanic costs associated with that. And so that would go back to some of the things that could be used to keep and strengthen the Affordable Care Act or some other system by going in that direction. I did want to ask you something else, too. Now, just also to keeping the prices or cost of healthcare down, can healthcare be used to create incentives for good behavior? And what do you think that might look like?
Yeah, I certainly believe that. In our current system, of course, would be health insurance creating those incentives, or employers. What you've seen over the past decade is a lot of employers turning to wellness classes, smoking cessation, exercise, diabetes classes, because diabetes, as you probably know, is burgeoning, and the rate of diabetes is going way up, and that's something that can be treated with some pretty simple lifestyle approaches. Exercise is key, you know, having fitness classes, eating well classes, teaching people how to read labels on food. A lot of people didn't get that in school, and so I think
the reading
really
part.
Yeah, well, the labels part. I mean, a lot of people don't think to look at the label to see how much salt. I mean, salt is a huge problem for people with high blood pressure, heart disease, and so forth. So what employers and some of the health insurance companies, they're a little more progressive, have found is that when they do this, when they have more prevention, more healthy living classes, they actually reduce their costs for covering patients. And so it both brings costs down, but it also makes for a healthier population, which is what we want.
All right, fantastic. Steve, anything that you would like to... What do you think about that?
One of the things that, because I know we're getting short on time, but going back to the first question and keeping the Affordable Care Act, paid for preventative care. And after a couple of years, the insurance companies started to change the definition. And so if a person went in to get a physical fully, just as their annual physical, and they found anything, even slightly out of the okay margins, they put that a code on that as being a diagnostic, and they denied the entire physical, and that's just gaming the system. And I have to tell you, you know, the idea of preventative care, it goes a lot farther than just the incentivizing. You have to encourage and motivate people to actually do it. But anyway, as you know, both Ed and I are into that as a day job as well. And, you know, we try to help people, and it goes back to the thing, like you talked about with the diabetes, literally helping a person learn how to manage their diabetes. They will never end up at the ER. And the way it used to.
It makes such a big difference.
It's huge. Yeah. And on every aspect, quality of life as well as the financial piece. And so anyway, and what you guys were talking about before, the specialist versus the general practitioners, that alone would probably get rid of about 20% of the bottlenecks in the early part of the system. And get people treated before their diseases got so out of control.
Exactly. I mean, you don't have to go to a specialist if you're healthy.
Exactly.
And if you've been taught and know how to engage in preventative work, and if your family doc coaches you, or your nurse practitioner, or, you know, midwife, whatever, then you don't need that much, much more expensive care. And you feel better, too.
Right.
Well, Diane, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on weight off your shoulders. And thank you, Steve, for coming in. And as we are literally two sides of the aisle, but we have utilitarian purpose and,
yep.
and respect for just simple, basic information that is above the ideological and religious divides that are being put upon us. And I think the student...
coming to the table is so important, and putting aside all that junk and saying, okay, how do we solve the problem?
Yeah, I mean, I could demand that everyone become a vegan.
And you would probably get a great response, Ed.
Well, you'd have to provide cookbooks.
All right. I'm on that. Thank you, Diane. Thank you, audience. Thank you, Coloradans, for being interested in your health care.
Hey, thanks, you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Bye, Diane.
Bye, Diane.
Good to see you.